recognizing really common skin infections in the hospital.
Can medications prevent delirium in ICU patients?
How can we manage acute respiratory distress syndrome?
And do we need expensive medications to prevent blood clots after hip or knee replacement?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine and president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine here.
So in this flu season, where we're taking a look at all of these people who are getting hospitalized with the flu, I think we should turn first to the management of acute respiratory distress syndrome. This is a review paper that's in the Journal of the American Medical Association. So it takes a look at a very large number of studies and best practices. For me, I think one of the noteworthy things about this was that they identified prone positioning, putting somebody on their stomach rather than on their back while they're being ventilated, as something that can be important in helping people survive. Other than that, though, they said, hey, we really do still need mechanical ventilation.
So, Elizabeth, ventilating somebody while they're laying flat on their stomach reduces mortality in individuals that have the most severe involvement with what's called acute respiratory distress syndrome, which is a leaking of fluid in the air sacs that prevents adequate oxygenation. As you said, it usually occurs in the ICU after things like infection or pancreatitis or trauma. As you mentioned, mechanical ventilation ends up being important, but if applied inappropriately, it actually worsens the injury. So for example, when I trained, we tried to use the highest amount of pressures and high volumes to try to pop those airways open. And we now know that that leads to mechanical or ventilatory injury and makes things worse. So this article not only talks about the use of mechanical ventilation, but how to apply it to minimize an injury. The other thing that was important about this is there have been a number of different medications that have been studied in this condition, and none of them have been helpful. So the most important thing is to properly mechanically ventilate these patients until they can get over their acute lung injury.
I think we reported a few years ago this idea that the tidal volume really needs to be appropriate for the size of the person, but at least I've witnessed clinically some challenges with regard to implementing that. Have you seen the same thing?
For those that aren't familiar, tidal volume is the amount or the volume of air that you put into the individual with each breath. And what happens with ARDS is it makes the lungs stiffer, oftentimes requires a little bit higher pressure. So the value of this particular study is it goes into great detail to highlight the best therapy in these individuals.
Well, as I suggested, right now in our current flu season, lots of people being hospitalized. One of the concerns, of course, is that there are inadequate numbers of ventilators if we really had a pandemic.
Unfortunately, that hasn't been the case now. But as you allude to, we lose more people through deaths from ARDS than we do, for example, through HIV or cancer on an annual basis. So the proper treatment, trying to prevent it by treating the acute injury before it becomes an issue, is also important.
Okay. Let's turn to one of yours then. I love the way that you served it up. In the New England Journal of Medicine, what I said, anticoagulation after someone has hip or knee replacement, you said, wow, do we need to use the expensive stuff?
Hip and knee replacement are two of the most common orthopedic surgeries done, not only in the United States, but across the world as well. And individuals that have those surgeries are predisposed to developing a clot in their lower extremity that could move to the lung. And both of these conditions, that is deep vein thrombosis and pulmonary embolism, collectively are known as venous thromboembolism. People are most likely to get this within several weeks after their surgery, so they're prescribed anticoagulation medication to prevent the blood clots for between 2 and 5 weeks after the surgery. Most commonly prescribed are oral anticoagulants, these new medications called NOACs or low molecular weight heparin. They've been proven to be effective. But the real question is, can we use something that may be just as effective, a lot less expensive, with an acceptable side effect profile? Here enters aspirin. One of the more commonly used anticoagulants, rivaroxaban, cost about $400 for a 1 month supply. Aspirin is pennies on the dollar. What the study investigators did was they looked at over 3,400 patients who were having a knee or hip replacement. They put them on rivaroxaban for 5 days after the surgery, but then after that, they either switched them to aspirin or continued them on rivaroxaban and followed them up for 90 days to look at the incidence of venous thromboembolism. And what they discovered was there was no difference between the therapies. the incidence of venous thromboembolism was less than 1% with either of those therapies, and there was no increased bleeding risk with either of the therapies. What that means is we can treat people with rivaroxaban for a short period of time, for 5 days after hip or knee replacement, and then switch them to a less expensive aspirin.
Plus easier for everybody because you can buy that just over the counter almost anywhere. Here's one question about that. Why do you say they need to have the rivaroxaban in the 5 days post-surgically?
Well, we don't have any studies that have used only aspirin and compared that to what I'm going to call more effective anticoagulants.
Okay. Now let's turn to a journal that I don't think in the many years we've been recording we have actually ever reported from. That's JAMA Dermatology. Right now, a big dermatology meeting going on. And I thought this one was fascinating because I've seen so many people who've been in the hospital with cellulitis, pretty severe skin infection that actually can result in some significant mortality in some folks. What they did, and there's actually two studies in JAMA Dermatology, is they had inpatient dermatologists come and consult on these folks. And they showed that there was a really positive impact on duration of antibiotic use, on how long they were hospitalized. It turned out to be a good thing, suggesting at the end of the day that we ought to have a subspecialty of inpatient dermatology and get these folks to round and consult.
Cellulitis, infection of the skin and soft tissue, is a clinical diagnosis. There's no test you can hang your hat on. And most commonly, that's treated by either emergency room physicians or primary care physicians in the hospital. Most of the time, we don't really think that we need a dermatologist to help with that condition. But what this study showed was that a third of the time, or was thought to be the diagnosis, it was incorrect. It was called pseudocellulitis. And in those individuals, antibiotics may not be helpful. Secondly, is oftentimes, we don't know what the appropriate duration of antibiotic therapy is. So a large number of these patients that weren't cured by the dermatologist were on antibiotics for a longer period of time than they should have been. And then lastly, dermatologists improved wound care in a half the individuals. So their expertise helped the patients get better, use fewer antibiotics. It actually saved about $600 per patient to have the dermatologist see them. So I'm glad you picked this particular article.
I was startled, actually, by the magnitude of the savings if you have this kind of a consult.
I agree with you. We spend over $4.5 billion in about 650,000 hospitalizations annually with this. The estimated cost savings is over $200 million by getting the dermatologist involved.
Win-win. Finally, let's turn back to you. Another really important problem in the hospital, the development of delirium in folks in the ICU. And is there anything we can really do about that?
It's estimated about a third of patients that spend time in the ICU two or more days will develop delirium. We'd like to prevent that because that delirium is associated not only with long-term cognitive defects, but it can actually prolong the hospitalization. It prolongs mechanical ventilation. It increases hospital costs. There's been a lot of enthusiasm for using a long available antipsychotic named Haldol or haloperidol to prevent delirium. We used it 35 years ago when I was training, and it continues to be used. Is it really effective? And we don't really have any studies to establish that. So these investigators did that by looking at almost 2,000 critically ill adults at 21 different ICUs that were at risk of developing delirium. And half of them got randomized to Haldol at one of two doses, and half of them got routine care. Those that were true with Haldol, it didn't improve their survival at 28 days, it didn't improve their survival at 90 days, and it didn't decrease either the incidence of delirium or when patients got it, its duration as well.
Well, I certainly am in favor of a reduction of the use of drugs in all settings, actually, if they're not really needed, if they don't exert a benefit. And I would love to see us get our arms around ways to effectively prevent delirium because it's so troubling, not just for the patient, but also for the family.
In fairness, what the investigators did for all the patients was they put in strategies designed to decrease the risk of delirium. These are non-pharmacologic strategies, things like making sure you mobilize the patient as quickly as possible. You try to improve the circadian rhythm of the patients. You try to prevent over-sedation. And you try to use visual and audio aids to keep them in the proper day sleep cycle. These things have been shown to help prevent delirium. And this was applied to all the patients. So when you do that, the addition of Haldol was not beneficial. That's why for our non-medical people listening, many of us will have relatives in the ICU and demanding that the doctor give a medication to prevent delirium, what I want them to know is we don't have any such medications available now.
Right, so maybe they can be helpful with regard to some of these other strategies like the early mobilization.
Exactly, and trying to preserve the sleep-wake cycle as well, and not trying to over-sedate the patient.
Very good. I'm going to talk about that one this week on the blog. So that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.